Hi, this is Jury Duty. I'm your host, Chris Terracone. As we mentioned at the beginning of yesterday's podcast, we have paused our coverage of the trial of Alex Murdaugh for the next 7 weeks. This week, in recognition of the death of O.J. Simpson last Wednesday, April 10th, we are reaching into the archives of Crime Story Media to present a series of special interviews related to the way that the historical narrative of Simpson's trial for the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman has been preserved for posterity. We began yesterday with Carrie Antholis' exclusive interview with Bill Hodgman, who had oversight responsibilities for the team prosecuting O.J. Simpson. Today, we present part one of Carrie's two-part interview with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander, the creators of the Emmy and Golden Globe-winning limited series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. One further programming reminder. In parallel with the premiere of The Jinx 2 on the Max streaming service, we are scheduling a special event for Season 10 of the Jury Duty podcast. For each of the 6 weeks of The Jinx 2 series, we will re-release four of our favorite episodes about the Durst trial from the Jury Duty feed, for a total of 24 episodes. The first episode of Jury Duty, The Durst Trial's Greatest Hits, will drop on April 22nd. Now, on to part one of Carrie's two-part interview with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander, which was conducted in the spring of 2018 at USC's School of Cinematic Arts in Los Angeles.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Today's podcast is a conversation with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander, creators, executive producers, and writers of the Emmy and Golden Globe-winning limited series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, as well as many other award-winning films and television programs. The conversation was recorded as part of a series of classes that I taught at the University of Southern California's School of Cinematic Arts. Each week, I would host an artist for a discussion that would help us better understand their values and aims as storytellers in the world of crime and justice. During part one of our conversation, we discussed how they met, their development as storytellers, the evolution of their partnership, how they became known as the kings of the anti-biopic, how they came to write The People vs. O.J. Simpson, the writing process on the series, and we began a discussion of how the production itself came together. And so, without further ado, here is my conversation with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander.
We were once in your shoes, by the way. We were undergraduate film students at SC. So,
and before I forget, Cardinal Gold. That's just for you guys.
So let's start at the beginning. Where are you guys from? How did you meet? And when did you start writing together?
We were freshman roommates.
We were in Mark's Tower.
Yeah.
Hey, there we
Woo-hoo!
Go.
Okay. I mean, technically, we were not roommates at first. I had a room in Mark's Tower that didn't have a roommate, and Scott had a room that had two roommates. And we met on a line getting the lunch card or whatever that was. And I found out that he lived in town and he was a cinema major and he was talking about all these kind of cool things. And I'm from Indiana and I didn't know about these things. And so we messed with the system a bit and we became roommates.
And take us through some of the key mileposts between being freshman at USC and your first produced script. What were some of the breaks? Who were some of the mentors along the way? And why did you want to be writers?
We didn't choose to be writers. It just kind of happened. Back when we were here, you weren't supposed to write a feature screenplay, and nobody did. You were expected to graduate, and this is for grad and undergrad, with 40 pages. And that's all that was expected of students.
You would do like an outline and write the first act. That was really what people did.
Yeah. I saw a tragic newspaper story about a kid who'd fallen through a roof and gotten paralyzed. And then I started telling Larry about it, and we started talking, and then we started joking about it. And sort of by the end of it, we had suddenly turned it into a story about Albert Brooks owning a house in Morris Day of the time, falls through his roof, and then Walter Matthau lives next door. And we had come up with this like funny story, and we said, well, what if we write a script? And we literally did not know one person who had written a screenplay, because no one at USC wrote scripts. No one in any film school in the country wrote a whole script.
Back in those days, you broke in by making a short film. Like, if you think about the people, the giants of USC, the, you know, Lucas and Zemeckis.
Fairbanks.
And they made short films, and that's how they got into the system. This was also early days of actually owning a computer.
I was an early adapter. I had a K-Pro 2X where you would have to load the floppy disk to put in the hardware and then load your file. And you could only put one act on each disk because the storage, I think, was 128 kilobytes.
So anyway, we were roommates at the time. We basically pounded out this screenplay. And
just for fun. I don't even know if it exists anymore, but for many years there was a big spec marketplace, and a lot of people, you know, you'd hear about the $1 million spec sales and all that. That all came after the 1988 Writers Guild strike, where nobody worked for 5.5 months, so everybody wrote spec scripts, and that invented the spec market in Hollywood. This is back in 1985 when we're writing that script.
Right, and so, we basically wound up selling 2 weeks after we graduated. I worked at a record store across the street when it was University Village, which is now not there anymore.
Couldn't even recognize it.
Yeah, and he was working on a low-budget horror film, and we had managed to get agents. We got agents because I was a TA, and someone in that class was now an intern at ICM, and they got asked by a young agent, like, who was good at USC, and they gave them my number, and I got a phone call, and we had the script. And so it was actually one of those things where they say, what, luck is like when opportunity meets preparation. It's like we actually had something, and we gave it to her. And about, you know, I'll say a month later, it sold, and we had an office at 20th Century Fox. And
sold in a bidding war between four studios. Yeah,
and we've been writing together ever since.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And now, back to Cary Antholis' interview with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander.
What was your first produced script?
You guys have all these classes now about, like, how to work in Hollywood and how to navigate the system and how to do a pitch and how to get an agent. SC didn't have anything like that. So we write the script, we sell it. 2 weeks after graduation, we have an office at 20th Century Fox. We don't know anything. I mean, we literally knew nothing. And then we get assigned these big shot producers, Imagine Films. It's Ron Howard and Brian Grazer. And we have this big shot head of the studio, Scott Rudin. And they wanted very different movies. The producers wanted a broad family comedy, and Rudin wanted it to be more like a Billy Wilder, like courtroom comedy. And experienced writers would sort of know how to navigate different points of view. And this is what you're going to spend your lives doing. Is you're trying to do a project and it's something you love, and then you go into a room with people who say, hey, maybe I'll give you money for your project, or maybe I'll make your project, but we have some notes. You're like, oh, okay. And then a person across the room says, I've got notes, but that person's notes aren't that person's notes. And you have to learn how to make people think they're happy. That's the secret. And back then, I mean, I was still 22 years old when we sold this script. We didn't understand this thing that you had to keep all the parties happy or else the project dies. And we spent a year doing development hell and balancing between these different points of view, and this little 105-page script turned into like 135 pages, and then after a year, they fired us. And then we didn't work for 6 months, because that's Hollywood.
Our second script was the script that got made. It was a movie called Problem Child.
And, ooh.
And, We made Problem
John
Child.
Ritter. Come on, guys.
And we basically worked on Problem Child 1 and Problem Child 2. It wasn't necessarily a happy situation, but they made lots of money and they were really successful. But the problem is that they weren't really the kind of movies that we wanted to make. It sort of got dumbed down in production. And so we kind of thought like maybe we'd started our career the wrong way, that we had started with these kind of broad comedies and we were quite successful. But we kind of said, well, maybe we should do something more independent and more personal. I'd always talked to Scott, even had come up with a treatment while he was at SC about making a movie about a guy named Ed Wood, who was kind of famous for being the worst filmmaker of all time. And so we wrote a treatment for that really, really quickly. And through a series of friends, it got on Tim Burton's desk and he became obsessed with it. And then that's really the movie that launched our careers in a big way.
And since then, you've become known as the kings of the anti-biopic. It's a word that a lot of critics use to describe the kinds of films about real people that you do. What does that mean to you when people say it?
Well, it's a little more common now. Back in when we did Ed Wood, people like Ed Wood didn't get movies made about them. That when people made movies based on a true story, they were about great people or important people. They were Gandhi. They were Patton. They were, you know, movies that were like, you know, 3 hours long and, you know, just told some just gigantic. They were boring. They were like these big epic sweep. And we thought, why can't you make just biographical movies about like the sort of like pop culture people that we dug and
who weren't necessarily good at what they did or successful, but they were interesting to us. The first one was at whatever. We didn't have some big agenda like, oh, and now for the next 30 years, we're going to write anti-biopics. At the time, Ed Wood was a figure of mockery. And there were these book called The Golden Turkey Awards, the 50 worst films of all times. And he was just, people would just make fun of him. And then there was this traveling show where you'd go to the New Art and you'd see the triple feature. And then they'd come out between the movies and they would make fun of the films and point out all the continuity mistakes. And the Problem Child movies got very, very bad reviews. And we didn't set out to write shitty movies. We thought we wrote a pretty good script, but then it got rewritten and dumbed down. And I had also worked on these low-budget horror movies. And people usually don't set out to make crap. Crap just usually happens. And we started feeling kind of sorry for ourselves with, like, we couldn't get a job and the bad reviews. And then we started thinking about Ed Wood going, what if you don't make fun of the guy? What if you celebrate him? What if you say, he came out to Hollywood with a dream and he directed 6 feature films. And that's more than most people. So why don't we go hooray for Ed and let him have his weird obsessions and his weird passions, and that'll drive the movie and we're not going to knock him for it. And this is a totally weird way of looking at this guy who was in the fringes of the margins. And we started doing our research and we loved fringy showbiz. We loved the people in the shadows and the people who are normally ignored. Ed and a lot of our biopics are just sort of about like little traveling freak shows. It's a psychic. It's a vampire. It's a 400-pound wrestler. You know, it's a weird collection of people, but we're celebrating them.
There are two really significant filmmakers that you worked with on those anti-biopics, Tim Burton and Milos Forman. Can you tell us about what you got from those guys in the process of working with them, what the experiences were like, and whether it was a fulfilling experience, gratifying experience?
For both those guys, it was kind of amazing. And they're both extremely different filmmakers, but they both captured our work really, really well in sort of a different kind of way. We made two movies with each guy, where Tim is very stylized and, you know, definitely puts his stamp of Tim Burton on everything. But Tim was insanely faithful to both scripts that we wrote with him. We made a movie called Big Eyes with him as well. Tim really took our pieces and filmed them with, like, you know, with a little bit of the Burton world in it. They're probably the least Tim Burton of Tim Burton's movies because they take place in the real world. But Tim is actually just a really good, straightforward director. He's also a great director of actors. Where Milos is much more about, like, trying to find the truth of things. He comes from Czechoslovakia. He comes from naturalism. And so, you know, he'll cast a real judge to play a judge or, you know, whatever he does. You know, he's trying to get, you know, what's it all about. And he was also much more free with the actors in terms of improv and finding the characters and things like that. But we had, I think, a magnificent, experience on both those guys. We made Man on the Moon with Milos as well.
It's interesting how, I mean, all four of those movies are very much Scott and Larry movies, but they also, the two are very much Tim movies, the two are very much Milos movies. I mean, Milos's body work is actually pretty small. For guys who directed two best pictures, I think he's only made, what, 9 or 10 films? Yeah. But Milos always makes movies about the iconoclast, the outsider, the guy, I mean, whatever. He did Amadeus, he did Cuckoo's Nest, you know, the guy who's fighting the system. And that's what Larry Flynt is, and that's what Andy Kaufman is. And Milos totally identified with that. I mean, Milos also took, we wrote the script for a studio on a pitch, and then it was going out to directors, and it was going out to all these comedy directors, comedy with a K, because we had told them we had written it for Bill Murray because we knew Bill from Ed Wood. And all these foreign directors started like falling in over the transom who were asking to direct the movie. And we kind of figured out what was going on was they all came from countries that didn't have the First Amendment. They didn't have free speech. And so they were all appreciating the message of the film. I'm jumping all over the place here, but all of our movies, it's like, what's it about? It's a biopic of Larry Flynt. What's it really about? It's about free speech. Ed Wood is about the worst filmmaker of all time. What's it really about? It's about the relationship between him and Lugosi. And so it was really, the movie was like this giant civics lesson salute to how you have to draw a hard line in the sand with free speech, and you can't rub it at all. And all the foreigners were getting it. And Milos's parents were killed by the Nazis, and his father was killed because he was a college professor. And so Milos, for him, he took the message of the movie really personally. And so he was just engaged emotionally on so many levels.
Also, I'll say what Tim and Milos have in common with us is that we like to mix tones. That for us, we like to have comedy and tragedy and drama all mixed in together. I mean, you guys just watched two episodes of OJ, and OJ goes from being incredibly sad and tragic to really funny at times, and you got to see it in a big group of people. I'm sure there were a couple times where you can't believe you're laughing at what's going on. Both these guys really appreciate the absurdity of things, and that's what we do too. But a lot of directors, they're trained to not do that, that you're supposed to sort of declare a major and that this is a drama or this is a comedy, because often when you do mix tones, you can't handle it and it floats away. But with both Tim and us and Milos recognizes that's kind of what life is all about, that there's something funny happens and something bad happens all in the same day. And that's how we write our scenes.
Tell us how you got involved in The People versus O.J. Simpson.
We had an agent for 22 years, which is crazy. And then he got sick of Hollywood and he retired. And we bounced around with a few new agents. And then we couldn't really find a good match. And then we finally found a guy who wanted to be our agent. And the reason he wanted to be our agent was when he was in college, Ed Wood came out. And it convinced him he wanted to work in showbiz. And so he was like our super fan. So when we signed with him, and he's a feature agent, he said, it's CAA. He says, if you guys sign here, you have to sign with a TV agent. We were like, yeah, we don't do TV. And we've never had a TV agent. We don't care about that stuff. He says, well, it's kind of the deal. Otherwise, you can't sign here. We're like, fine. So he mentioned a TV agent who I actually knew because he was a dad from the elementary school my kids went to. So I knew him from the playground. So it's like, fine. It's like, we'll never talk to this guy again. And so we signed with CAA. And the next day, Joe calls us up saying, two producers just came in and they have the rights to a Jeff Toobin book about O.J. Simpson trial. Do you guys want to do it as a miniseries? And we look at each other, we go, okay.
Which is crazy because, I mean,
it's insane.
Here's the thing. We never take a job like that.
We pass on everything.
We pass on everything. And also, even the things we wind up taking, we argue about for 2 months before we decide to do it. The second there was a young producer named Brad Simpson who went to a used bookstore and he found Jeffrey Toobin's book and was just sort of just basically asked him, well, about 20 years have gone by. Maybe someone should do something. So there wasn't like a take. It wasn't like there was something set up, but it was.
Actually, it's so cockamamie. I mean, he was in Vancouver shooting Diary of a Wimpy Kid. And he was up there alone without his family. And on weekends, he's just bored out of his mind. So that's why he was just like looking for like books to kill time with.
But here's the thing. The second Joe said O.J. Simpson as a miniseries, we were able to look at each other and say yes, because we just knew instantly that's how you tell that story. We were always fascinated by what happened in Los Angeles. We were here at the time, what happened in Los Angeles at that time period. But as a movie, it would simply be the stuff you already know. It would have been, you know, the Bronco chase that happened on page 10. and it'll just be all you just be hitting those greatest hits. And what was so fascinating about that trial was all the crazy friggin' places it went to. And so we realized that by having 10 hours, you could actually do it justice. You could embrace what made it such an important and special time, you know, in this city. We really looked at it as a TV show about this city.
So take us through the process from Joe reaching out to you and asking, and then...
In hindsight, it was very belabored for a TV show. And the reason is because Larry and I had never done TV and our producers had never done TV. And so nobody understood that you're supposed to do TV quickly. And Larry and I ended up spending 3 years on the show, which is not cost efficient, by the way, because they only pay you by the episode. So it was paid for 10 episodes over 3 years. So it wasn't smart. But I think the reason why the show turned out really great was we put so much thought into it. And we packed so much detail, and the more time we spent on it, we would have what we called salons with Brad Simpson and Nina Jacobson. We would just talk about the idea of gender politics, which is like never came up in 94 or 95 in terms of the Marsha issues and obviously the LAPD's history with blacks in the city. And then we started talking about how celebrities get different treatment than civilians. And some of this would come from like little details in Jeff Toobin's book that we'd really pick up on. And we'd say, isn't it easier to be a private attorney than in the DA's office? And then you start talking about, well, they have lots of worker bees in the private sector and they can afford a lot more assistance as opposed to Marsha, who's taking her homework home with her every night. And then you start trying to visualize these ideas. You go, okay, so when we write Shapiro scenes and Cochran scenes, we go in their offices. It's going to be carpeting. It's going to be sconces on the walls and soft lighting. And when we go into Marsha's office and Darden's office, it's going to be fluorescence and it's going to be linoleum. And you're like, think about this. And this is all like visual cues to the audience that it's easier to be on that side than on that side. And then, Kardashian, which was just like this gold mine that fell on us. And the fact that Kardashian was part of the trial and he had this crazy character arc. And then we started saying we can use Kardashian. It's sort of this metaphor for the beginning of reality TV and how the OJ trial invented reality TV. And then the 24-hour news cycle began in that time with CNN. And so, like, there was all this stuff going on in addition to the fact that it divided the country racially. But we were finding all this other stuff to think about. You know, and then we had Toobin's book, and then everybody else had written a book. So we read everybody else's book, and we just fell into this black hole. And nobody was pressuring us to turn in anything. So we spent a year before we turned in the pilot.
Did Nina and Brad have it set up at FX?
It was not FX. It was at Big Fox at the time. It was just going to be a miniseries. Ryan Murphy was not involved.
And that happened relatively quickly after you came on? Was it already set up
it was,
at Fox?
They had a deal for television at Fox. We had to come in there and sort of like tell them what we wanted to do. But it was pretty minimal what we had to do. And then they got set up. And we worked with Nina and Brad for a while.
The pitch was kind of bullshit. The pitch was only 15 minutes long because we actually had nothing. But... everything we pitched in that 15 minutes ended up being what the show was.
Right. I wouldn't say it was bullshit.
Fine. But it was
a choice 15 minutes.
Yeah, but you and I sort of felt like we barely got anything here, but we're a little cocky. It's like going to be the tone of People versus Larry Flint. We knew that. But we made a decision. And when I mentioned Ed Wood, I said it was about a guy who's passionate. And all of our biopics are about people who are passionate. That is like the core of all of our movies. It's about somebody who really wants something and they're just willing to swim upstream and they make no sense and they're probably wrong, but they won't back down. And that's the charm of the stories. And we said, who are the passionate characters in the OJ trial? It's Marsha, it's Darden, and it's Johnny.
Right.
And those are the three.
And that actually surprised them because it wasn't OJ. I mean, we came in to pitch them an OJ Simpson tale in which OJ was definitely a supporting person.
Our pitch basically was... saying it's those three characters, and here's the story of Marsha, here's the story of Chris, and here's the story of Johnny. And we said, and we're going to open with the Rodney King beating. And the exec said, what? We go, we're going to open with Rodney King, and then we're going to cut to the riots. And she says, that's a different year? We go, yeah, the riots are 92. Charles, the murders are 94. Well, why are you doing that? We go, because that's the umbrella for the story. Because... that's what it's all about, dummy. At the end of the day, that's what the story's about. The story is about how the LAPD treats blacks in LA. And she was a little like, she didn't know quite how to react to that. Like, this isn't what I thought you were coming in to sell me, but I wasn't expecting to hear about Rodney King today, but okay. And we said, it's Rodney King, it's the riots, it's those three characters, and that's the story. And that ended up being the show.
We spent a while with just ourselves and working with Nina and Brad, and we came up with sort of an outline for, at the time, it was going to be 11 episodes. We had talked initially about making, I think you guys saw 1 and 9 tonight, so the first like 15 minutes of 1 initially was going to be a full hour. The idea of doing a procedural just based on what happened the first night. And that was sort of us, it was sort of came to us like having a conversation about, are we making 10 one-hour movies or 1 10-hour movie? And the 1 10-hour movie idea that was like, you know, sort of like the first 10 pages of the movie or whatever. But what we realized, that's not really what television is, that, you know, if you just did the first night as the first episode, you're not meeting Johnny Cochran. You're not meeting Chris Darden. You're not meeting a lot of the characters that take us through this all. It's everything. I mean, there's certainly an hour worth of material that happens that first night, but it wasn't what the rest of the show was going to be. So we pretty early on abandoned the idea and just brought it down to 10 episodes and had that just be the opening. So we get on to, made the first episode the first week as opposed to the first day.
FX was totally supportive, and their notes tended to be very minimal. But I mean, John Landgraf, who's a brilliant, very choice. And it sort of came down to, guys, we got to be on that freeway the end of the first night. You figure it out. I don't really care how you do it. If the episode runs sloppy long, we're very forgiving around here. And every other network, you get 42 minutes. You come in at FX, you come in at 1 hour and 8. We'll look the other way. They were great, but that Bronco's got to be on the freeway. And so we sort of like had to back into that.
We talked a lot about movies in the 1970s while we were writing it. I mean, initially we talked a lot about the films of Robert Altman, because what we noticed about the whole O.J. Simpson trial was that every person involved thought that they were the star. It, you know, most times the television show will have like one protagonist. And we felt here that everybody, is one of the crazy things about, everybody's an alpha character. Everybody, when they are in a scene, they think that
especially Shapiro.
Yeah, it's a Shapiro movie.
Shapiro thinks he's the star of that miniseries.
But Cochran certainly does. I mean, everybody kind of did. And so we thought this idea that where, you know, it's this, Robert Altman was a director in the 70s who sort of pioneered, like, he put a microphone on every single character and would sometimes have multiple cameras running and would be basically treating every actor in the movie as if they were the star of the film.
Now, Larry's a bigger fan of Altman than I am, so.
I wouldn't
have gone so far, but yes. That's okay.
We also talked a lot about certain true life movies of the 70s, like All the President's Men, which is about Watergate, that plays like a thriller, even though you know the end of the movie, you know that Nixon's going to resign and be taken down. And we knew that here, that people would have that problem where, like, there's so many jokes, like on Twitter when we first started the show, saying like, oh, I know how it ends, you know, but it didn't matter. You were still compelled to watch it and treating it like a thriller.
I don't think you mentioned the only movie I remember talking about, which is Dog Day Afternoon. Have you guys seen Dog Day Afternoon? I hope you've all seen it, because it's a perfect film and you better all go see it as soon as you go home tonight. It's based on a true life event. And it's hilariously funny. It's tragic. It's dramatic. It's thrilling. It's gripping. It's real. It's got a lot of broad jokes, but that walk right up to the edge of always being straight and believable. And we talk constantly about Dog Day Afternoon. Sometimes the other producers would talk about Network. Obviously, there's a lot of TV shtick in OJ, but Network is broader, and it probably crosses the line that we were trying not to cross. Though we did get our Domino's pizza joke, so we sold it to Big Fox. And Fox, at the time, because these companies, like, you know, hire and fire people every week, had a special events division, whatever that means. And the special events division would then farm out production to FX Studios, which is a subdivision of FX Network. And so we were working with FX Studios as the producers to produce the miniseries for Fox, for Big Fox, Channel 11 Fox. At some point during that, the president of Fox got fired. So now we're developing this series, but there's nobody actually in charge of us. And we turned in our pilot, and John Landgraf, who runs FX, read it because he oversees the division that was our studio. And he's like, I'm going to steal this thing. This is good. And so he basically called up the suits at Fox saying, you know what, let's just move this over to FX. Everyone at FX was totally supportive. So that was good for us.
We brought in a writing staff. I mean, we'd outlined the 10 episodes.
So did he did he green light it at that point? Was it?
I mean, green lighting is a hard thing to say until you're actually shooting. I mean, people use that term really loosely.
Right.
You know, we were technically greenlit on a movie that a month ago, and now we're not greenlit.
We were on it for 2 years before it started shooting.
We had outlined 10 things. We'd written
written
the first two. We knew where everything was going, but we'd never done television. People said you got to have the writer's room for television. So we brought in a small writer's room, which we used more because we kind of knew what the episodes were all going to be. We used it more like a think tank. We use it more as like, hey, we'd assign people things like read every book done by the jurors. We're going to do a jury episode. And so like you come back with 10 facts about the jury. And so,
there are 3 books written by jurors.
Yeah. So
there's so much stuff out there.
We had about 6 episodes written, and FX was basically, we were in the line for production. But we also realized that we had done the one thing in television you can't make money off of, which is that we created a miniseries that had a beginning and an end. And so we were sort of curious how this could be an ongoing thing. And that's when Ryan Murphy came in. He was doing American Horror Story, and he thought, what about doing American Crime Story? And so that's how that happened.
So you get cast, and you got a start date. Tell us about your ongoing involvement. Were scripts caught up to production? Did you start with 10 scripts?
That was really annoying because we were so ahead of the game. And then it just, at a certain point, it just turned into the Indiana Jones with the big rock rolling after him, where it just somehow the rock kept getting closer to us, which we couldn't figure out why. We had almost all the scripts done, but then it seemed like we had nothing finished. Ryan was the only like TV professional, the only person who had ever done a series before, and he was sort of saying, "You got to get everybody into episode one." And suddenly we're like, "Really?" He's like, "Yeah." So then it's like, okay, well, let's go back and figure out how to move up Johnny, how to give Darden more scenes. And you know,
it was more Darden, because Johnny was actually in episode one, but Darden was not. And so the scene where Darden and Johnny had that face-off that you saw tonight, that was one of the last scenes we wrote for
And then Cuba got cast, and most people who got cast were everybody's first choice. And as soon as we got Cuba, OJ was barely in our outline. We were taking our lead a lot from Tubin's book, and Tubin was very dismissive of OJ, saying, you know, OJ had nothing to do with his defense. OJ had the most expensive lawyers in the country. They were running the show, and he was just...
I mean, part of the problem is that OJ's in jail, so there's nothing he really can do, in a sense.
He's not active. Yeah. But when we got Cuba, we're saying, oh, geez, I mean, the guy has an Oscar. Don't we have to give him a bunch of good scenes? So then we had to kind of take a step back and say, all right, OJ was never going to be the star of the miniseries. We just had to kind of reverse engineer to figure out, okay, how can we give the guy playing OJ a lot more to do?
We never quite got caught up because the later episodes we just tinkered with for a longer time. I referred to it earlier as episode 8, which is we always thought of as going to be a special episode and that we tell it from the jury's point of view. And everyone loved that idea. And we knew that it was so many great stories from the juror's point of view. But what happened with that was, it was almost because of the quality of the show. Episodes 1 through 7 had such a narrative momentum that when you got to, all of a sudden you got this script in for 8, it was 24 new characters because there's all the alternate jurors. And all of a sudden it just never quite seemed to be working right. And I think actually looking back now, it was always working right. You know, it was always totally fine. It was always going to be a thing. But so we just wound up like rewriting and working with Joe Cole on it and doing all, I mean, just working it over and over and over and over and over again. So that sort of like wound up eating an insane amount of time just because it didn't have the same characters as the rest of the show did. And so we started putting more and more of our characters into that episode. That was probably the hardest one to actually get right.
Also, how did we get behind when we were kind of like 2 years ahead was current events. The Black Lives Matter movement started. You had Eric Garner. You had all of these Black Americans who were shot by police departments around the country, and it started becoming something that everyone was talking about. And we had had a theory going in. It's sort of like, you know, you arc out your story and you figure out, all right, who's the character here on page one, and then how are they going to change and what are they going to be at the end. And for us, for Johnny, it was all going to be about perception. So our original battle plan, I mean, you guys are too young, but Johnny was very divisive back in 94, 95. And basically, Black Americans loved him and white Americans just thought he was putting on a show. And there was even a character on Seinfeld who was a Johnny lookalike who would sort of make fun of Johnny. And our idea was that Johnny was going to enter the show in episodes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 or so as this showboat, as the guy in the lime green suits, and he's putting on a show, and we just think he's just in it for the cameras and for the glory and for the showbiz. And then you start to realize, oh my God, he's totally sincere. And then you start to learn episodes 6, 7, 8, 9. Oh my God, he's been doing this for 30 years. And he was doing civil rights cases back in the 60s. And you start learning all this. And then by episode 10, you sort of see the beating, or actually episode 9, the one you guys just saw, would reveal the beating heart of Johnny Cochran. That's how we described it. And when all this stuff started happening in the country, which I guess was like 2014, we got calls from FX saying, you guys aren't doing a period piece. You guys are doing a show about today. And nobody on any of our other biopics had ever given us his mandate, which is like, all right, you know, we're doing Man on the Moon. Man on the Moon's about, it's about the 70s and the early 80s, and we're going to have fun with that time period. And then FX was saying, you have to make it relevant to today, and you got to make it about today. And no one had ever put this conceit in our heads. And so at that point, we said, all right, you're right. You guys are right. It's too important what's going on in the country right now. And so the show has to reflect what is happening in America. And something that made us go, we have to completely change our concept of Johnny. And so the Johnny you saw in episode 1 defines himself from his opening scene.
Well, actually, no, I would say, strange enough, I was just thinking about it, that you guys almost get the arc immediately in the sense that the opening scene is more the our original conception of the peacock, is sort of the, you know, the where's my Hugo Boss. But by the second scene, by the second scene, which was the last one inserted in that episode, which was the scene with him and Darden, which is really where, you know, you find out that Johnny has been trying to get justice for this family of this person who was killed by the LAPD. It was true. Darden was the person on that case, and Darden thought he was trying to do the right thing, but was actually not really pleasing anybody.
But it's more than just adding that scene. I mean, in terms of why are we so far ahead and then how do we get so far behind, is we started rethinking what's Johnny going through. And suddenly Johnny's wife became a big character. And then we started writing all these scenes with Johnny at home, you know, sort of like grappling with the issues.
One of the things that really strikes me, having read the Tubin book back when it first came out, is that you guys really humanize these characters way more than he ever could.
I love Tubin, but Tubin's smarmy and looks down at these people at times and always has his news pundit thing going on, where it goes back to a little bit what I was talking about Altman. Everybody, we wanted you to understand them. And we thought that was part of the problem back in the 90s, that people didn't give these characters, these real people, their proper due. I mean, we wanted people who think that if you thought that you hated Marcia Clark, we wanted to make you understand what she went through. If you were a person who hated Johnny Cochran, we wanted you to understand how sincere he was in this battle.
We made the audience feel compassion for Judge Ito, of all people. You know, where suddenly, you know, his wife becomes part of the trial and he's just completely tortured.
And the craziest thing was discovering Kardashian was sort of one of the only people involved in this trial who was actually there for the right reason. Kardashian 1 was the only person on the Dream Team who wasn't famous back in 94, and now he's famous for something completely different, but he was the only guy there for the right reason. He was there because his best friend looked him in the eye and said he didn't do it. And so we were able to make this sort of sincerity of an arc for Kardashian, where he comes to not believe his friend. He comes to realize his friend was a killer.
And we love to do our research, and then we love to sort of like define all these little moments and then turn it into drama. And the moment of the verdict, and you guys can look it up on YouTube, you can watch the moment the clerk says not guilty, you see Kardashian's face drop. You see on the tape, he's rooting against OJ in that moment. And we thought,
my
that
God,
was,
what have I done?
Yeah, what have I done? And we thought that was amazing. We said, that's his story. It's a story about a guy who's completely loyal, and he keeps saying to him, but geez, you didn't do it. You didn't do it. No, I didn't do it. And then around episode 7 or 8, he's going, oh my God, he did it. But because I'm a loyal person, I will stick it out as I promised to. And the minute it's over, I'm out of here.
Tell us about putting the team together, the collaborations, not only with Ryan and with the writers, but with Anthony Hemingway and the directors that came in.
Anthony directed 5 of the episodes.
Anthony had done a lot of horror stories.
Yeah, and he was just terrific. I mean, we loved Anthony, and we met with him, and Ryan had worked with him before, and Anthony just seemed to really get it. We were very, very pleased. Episode 5 was directed by John Singleton, who
USC
went to USC, and we knew a little bit, and it was kind of we always wanted to work with John, and when that happened, I think that was, we felt great about working with John.
Actually, another USC guy, our DP Nelson Craig, who was wonderful, and I really went to bat for him because a friend runs Homeland, and he'd worked on Homeland, and he did this weird show I liked, Halt and Catch Fire, which I thought had a really distinctive like color palette, and it was really clever, and our other producers had no idea who Nelson was, and I really went to bat for him.
What was funny, though, in terms of the cast was, initially, I don't think we were going for this kind of like all-star thing. You know, in fact, as each time, it wound up just kind of snowballing. Sometimes what happens is you get a couple actors who say yes, and then instead of like having to search out for other actors, you get a lot of incoming.
Started with Travolta, didn't
it? Yeah, it was Cuba and Travolta. Cuba and Travolta were the first two people cast, and after that, it was just like, you know, you kind of have whoever you wanted. But the weird thing we wanted to be careful about, and we'd have a bunch of arguments about, was, is it becoming the Love Boat? It would say, is it just becoming the star of the week? And I would always counter, going back to once again the Altman, and it was that like, no, that this is totally fine. All these people do think they're stars; they should be stars.
You are so obsessed with Altman,
but I think it works.
You projects. Just keep talking about
but,
it.
But what happened, though, is that someone would come involved, like Barry Scheck. All these actors wanted to be part of the Dream Team because the Dream Team is like they were the Dream Team. And so, but what these actors didn't really realize is they would have these great opening scenes, and they would have a big dramatic moment in a couple places. But for the most part, they're going to be sitting at that table while Johnny gives speeches. Even John Travolta realized at some point, wait a second,
I'm sitting Nathan Lane. It was like the ultimate bait and switch.
Right.
He's like, oh, F. Lee Bailey. He's like, everyone, F. Lee Bailey's famous for all these speeches. And then I'm going to be sitting at that table for 5 months.
Right. And so it wound up being a little bit of a revolt at one point where the, you know, we had to balance out the actors. Like, all right, fine. We just need one or two of them there. Not everyone's there every day.
Okay, John, you can leave today. We'll have Nathan and Schwimmer.
With that, we bring to a close this episode of Jury Duty, The Legacy of the O.J. Trial. Please join us on our next installment as we present part two of Carrie's interview with Larry Karaszewski and Scott Alexander, the creators of the Emmy and Golden Globe winning limited series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. And if you would like to listen to these episodes early and ad-free, head over to our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You can find more information about this trial on our Jury Duty Crime Story Patreon page or at crimestory.com. Jury Duty is created and produced by Carrie and Tholis. It was co-produced by yours truly, Chris Terracone, and edited by Tristan Friedberg Rodman. Music for this episode was provided by Strike Audio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will come back for the next episode of Jury Duty.